Today is our last Sabbath of the 10th biblical month, the 29th day. And we're going to pick up with reading the book of Joshua. We just finished up the law out of Deuteronomy prior with the death of Moses and some explanation on it. And now we are getting into Israel's histories, which precedes the law, or, yeah, comes after the law, that is. And we'll be focusing on the destruction of Canaan and the people's rebellion and some of the other aspects of Israel's history that are good to contemplate as we consider our future. So, Joshua chapter 1. Now, after the death of Moses, the servant of Yahweh, it came to pass that Yahweh spake unto Joshua, son of Nun, Moses' minister, saying, Moses, my servant, is dead. Now therefore arise, go over this Jordan, thou and all this people, unto the land which I give to them, even to the children of Israel. Every place that the sole of your foot shall tread upon, that have I given unto you, as I said unto Moses. From the wilderness, in this Lebanon, even unto the great river, the river Euphrates, all the land of the Hittites, and unto the great sea towards the going down of the sun, which would be to the west, shall be your coast. There shall not any man be able to stand before thee all the days of thy life. As I was with Moses, so I will be with thee. I will not fail thee, nor forsake thee. Be strong and of a good courage. For unto this people shall thou divide for an inheritance the land which I swear unto their fathers to give them. Only be thou strong and very courageous, or be courageous, the most courageous of courageous would be the Hebrew way of looking at that thou may observe to do according to all the law which Moses my servant commanded thee. Turn not from it to the right hand or to the left, that thou mayest prosper whithersoever thou goest. Okay, so what we see here is that Yahweh is finally speaking to Joshua face to face because he was the appointed. We talked about the difference of biblical appointing versus modern day election and other types of government that are made, where this man who was said to be the servant or the minister of Moses, this man actually waited upon Moses like he was his master. He actually called him master multiple times in the Bible, even though Moses technically did not own him for any reason. He was a voluntary servant, a voluntary minister, a voluntary servant prior to Moses' death. So he, like Elijah and Elisha and other people in the Bible that you'll see have this type of relationship, he wanted to learn Moses' ways, be more like Moses, learn from Moses, so he placed himself unto a voluntary ministration to Moses. Nobody forced him to do it. He wanted the part. He was that type of person. And on account of it, Yahweh chose him and told Moses to appoint him, and they appoint him, and God appears to him or speaks to him after Moses was dead, to actually kind of give the seal of approval to Joshua that he was to lead the people, that he was the actual leader that Yahweh had chosen for his people. And he defines the boundaries of the land, but before he defines the boundaries, he makes a statement which I think can be separated from the statement to some extent because of the way it's spoken in other ways in the scripture. And that's in verse 3, where it says, every place that the sole of your foot shall tread upon, that have I given unto you, as I said unto Moses. Okay, this is the re-implications of the mandate given to Adam in Genesis 1:26, where he was to have dominion of the earth. And this is the idea that how beautiful upon the mountains are the feet that bring good news out of Isaiah chapter, I think it's 53. And the idea is that this power that is given to God's people for dominion in God's name to bring about God's kingdom on earth as it is in heaven may have to start somewhere, which it generally starts in the wilderness with rebellion, and then from that point forward it may end in a kingdom, and then it finally terminates into world dominion, which is supposed to happen on behalf of the Son of God, Christ, which Psalm 2 tells us the nations were all given to him as his inheritance. The ends of the earth were his possession. So I think we can safely conclude from a holistic biblical perspective that not just the land of Canaan, that was only the starting point, that was only the place where God wished the gospel to first start and take root, but from there on it was going to move out. But you have to notice also the requirements God places on Joshua. Joshua doesn't tell him, just because you're Joshua, everything that you do is going to be good. Everything you say is okay. When you speak to the people, it's going to be the rule of law because you're the leader. No, instead he says, "Be strong and of a good courage, for unto this people you will divide the land." That he swore, so he's going to effect a promise that was already given through him. But then he has that requirement added to it. He says, "Only be thou strong and very courageous, that thou may observe to do according to all the law." So he's telling him that it's going to take strength and courage so that he can observe God's law. It wasn't going to take strength and courage to necessarily kill the enemies or the inhabitants of the land. Yahweh promised he would take care of them by faith. But what he tells them is it's going to take strength and courage for him, like Moses, who at one point dropped the ball in speaking to the rock instead striking it. Joshua's going to have to be strong and of good courage to keep God's law and his commandments, that he doesn't turn his foot from it to the right or to the left, that he stays on the straight and narrow path like Christ taught us. So I think that we can see that this admonition and this backup of Joshua's not just being handed the leadership role, he's being handed the responsibility of, once again, like we talked about in the prior messages in Deuteronomy, that he as a ruler, or he as a judge, is going to have to observe the law scrupulously. Because if he doesn't, it's going to breed contempt for the law. The leader doesn't do it, the people won't do it. That's the real purpose of the ministry of leadership, is to show people an example, not to show them rebellion. So picking back up in 8, it continues in that thought. It says, "This book of the law shall not depart out of your mouth, but thou shalt meditate therein." That's Psalm 2. David was probably thinking of this when he wrote Psalm 1. "Meditate therein day and night," which is exactly what Psalm 1 says, "that thou may observe to do according to all that is written therein, for then thou shalt make thy way," or thy road, "prosperous, and then thou shalt have a good success." Only then. It doesn't take a strong leader, like people think in today's presidency. It doesn't take a Donald Trump or a George Washington. It takes someone who follows God's law, that leads the people in the right way. That's the only way you can have a good country, a good people, a good success, is if you have God's law primary. Not the Constitution, not some other laws of men, but God's law. It's the only way men are ever going to lead people in a righteous fashion. "Have not I commanded thee?" Yahweh asked. "Be strong and of a good courage. Be not afraid, neither be thou dismayed, for Yahweh thy God is with thee, wheresoever thou goest," wherever your feet go. Then Joshua commanded the officers of the people, saying, "Pass through the host, command the people, saying, prepare you victuals," food, "for within 3 days ye shall pass over this Jordan and go in to possess the land which Yahweh your God giveth you to possess it. And the Reubenites and the Gadites and half tribe of Manasseh spake to Joshua, saying, remember the word which Moses the servant of Yahweh commanded you, saying, Yahweh your God has given you rest and has given you this land." Your wives, your little ones, and your children shall remain in the land which Moses gave you on this side Jordan, but ye shall pass before your brethren armed, all the mighty men of valor, and help them until Yahweh has given you and your brethren rest, as he has given you, given your brethren rest as he has given you. And they also have possessed the land which Yahweh your God giveth them. Then ye shall return unto the land of your possession and enjoy it, which Moses, Yahweh's servant, gave on this side Jordan towards the sun rising, which would be towards the east, the place where the sun comes up. Okay, so this is the story about Reuben, Gad, and the half-tribe of Manasseh. They were given land on the previous side of the Jordan before the crossing over. They were given their possessions ahead of time, but they were made to swear an oath to say that they would not, definitely not stop helping Israel. Even after Moses died, they just wouldn't do that. And Joshua is reminding them of that promise that they made, that solemn promise that they were to help Israel win the battle or the war, and then they would go back and live in their land. It's also interesting to note that while the law does definitely give us the understanding that a man is not to put on that which pertains to a woman, which I think we've discussed before, literally means a geber in the Hebrew, a warrior, is not to wear what pertains to a woman, and a woman is not to wear that which pertains to a warrior, a geber, a man, that in 14 of verse one, of chapter 1, it specifically mentions that women and children were not to go over and fight for Yahweh. Yahweh did not include them as part of the host, as part of the army. They were not going to be counted as fighting men. Now, I know that that seems like, for any traditional Christian, that's an unsaid rule. But in our modern day, we don't see things that way, and it should be understood that Joshua definitely backs up that understanding by making that statement. If they didn't have that understanding prior, they definitely had it again by Joshua reminding them of that law, telling them how things were going to work. They probably didn't need reminded. If back then it was just an organic principle, they knew that women didn't belong in warfare due to natural reasoning. So, that is what it is. Let's go back to 16. It says, "Then answered Joshua, saying, All that thou commands us, we will do, and wheresoever thou sends us, we will go." So they say, basically, Joshua, you're the man, you're our captain, you will tell us where to go, and we'll go there. No matter what you tell us to do, we're behind you. So, that's an important part of being a good leader. "According as we have hearkened unto Moses in all things, so will we hearken unto thee. Only Yahweh thy God be with thee as he was with Moses. Whosoever he be that does rebel against thy commandment and will not hearken unto the words in all that thou commands him, he shall be put to death. Only be strong and of a good courage." Now this is an interesting part of military law. Okay, some people would call it martial law. Okay, in the United States they have certain laws that are followed during wartime, in the code called the UCMJ, all right, which used to define military conduct. All right, and in that same way there are certain laws that during a wartime event things are heightened. In other words, when you depend upon your men to be under command and you say, you have to go here and prepare, and then when this trumpet is blown or this happens, you attack because then I'm going to follow up and I'm going to attack with you. Okay? You're depending on those people. Those people need to be where they're at. If they've already volunteered to be in the battle, as per what we read in the law prior, in other words, when the captain went through the host and made his captains of 50s and 100s and 10s and all that, and he said, which one of you are weak and not strong, and which one of you want to go home, and all that kind of stuff that we had read before, if they pass through that agreement and they've committed, covenanted themselves into the army, from that point forward, those men can be put to death for not following orders, because other men's lives are going to depend upon them being where they're supposed to be and told what they're supposed to be told. They can't decide midway through the march that they're going home. They had to have made that choice from the beginning. Now, I know in times past I've thought that there's certain military events in history that I used to think was a little bit too harsh for them to have hung men for deserting during a military occasion. I thought, well, you know, they were weak. They should have had the right to go home because they would have just let their brethren down. But there is definitely a case out of the book of Joshua to be made that people who have once put their hand to the plow should not look back for the things that they've now left behind. The same idea that is in the working of the gospel, the working of God's army, is there for us to see also during warfare in Israel's invasion of Canaan. So it's an important aspect that the people back Joshua up by this. They say, not only are we going to follow you and our people are going to follow you, and everything that you say we're going to do, but if anybody argues with you and rebels against your commandments, if they won't do what they're told, if they won't hearken to your words, if they're rebellious to you, we're going to kill them. We're going to put that person to death. They deserve to die. All right? And in their case, it needed to be said, because the Reubenites, the Gadites, and the half-tribe of Manasseh could have crossed the Jordan, went back home, and lived in the land they were given, a possession that was done in agreement, in covenant, with them doing so. So it would have been a breaking of their covenant generationally by their fathers or them or whoever it was that made the deal with Moses, that they were going to help the people. The people needed their help. They couldn't have half the army. It was important that Israel fought the war together. Chapter 2. Joshua the son of Nun sent out of Shittim two men to spy secretly, saying, go view the land, even Jericho. And they went, and they came into a harlot's house named Rahab, and they lodged there. And it was told the king of Jericho, saying, behold, there came men in hither tonight of the children of Israel to search out the country. And the king of Jericho sent unto Rahab, saying, bring forth the men that are come to thee, which are entered into this house. For they be come to search out all the country. And the woman took the two men, and she hid them, and she said thus, there came men unto me, but I wist not whence they were. And it came to pass about the time of shutting of the gates, when it was dark, that the men went out. Whether the men went, I want not. Pursue after them quickly, for ye shall overtake them. But she had brought them up to the roof of the house, and hid them with the stalks of flax, which she had laid in order upon the roof. And the men pursued after them by the way to Jordan, unto the fords. And as soon as they were pursued after them, they were gone out. They shut the gate. And before they were laid down, she came up unto them upon the roof. And she said unto the men, I know that Yahweh has given you the land, and that your terror has fallen upon us, and that all the inhabitants of the land faint because of you. For we have heard how Yahweh dried up the waters of the Red Sea for you, and when ye came out of Egypt, and what ye did unto the two kings of the Amorites that were on the other side Jordan, Sihon and Og, whom you have utterly destroyed. And as soon as we have heard these things, our hearts did melt, neither did there remain any more courage in any man because of you. For Yahweh your God, He is God in heaven above and in the earth beneath. Now therefore, I pray you, swear unto me by Yahweh, since I have shown you this kindness, that ye will also show kindness to my father's house and give me a true token. Ye will save alive my father and my mother and my brethren and my sisters and all that they have, and deliver our lives from death. And the men answered her, Our life for yours. If you utter not this our business, and it shall be, when Yahweh has given us the land, that we will deal kindly and truly. There's our word amen that I always catch to let you know is there. And you say amen with thee. Okay, so there was an agreement made, and there's something that should be said here about this. So Yahweh charged the people that they were to kill all the Canaanites, so all the Canaanite inhabitants of the land. And so they went in as spies into Rahab's house, which, you know, by the way, was not a Canaanite name, but was an Israelite name, or a Hebrew name. I think that should be noted, that her name does not appear as commonly Canaanite. Not that the two couldn't have had similar languages, but I think it means seen of my father, if I'm correct. And that is kind of an interesting thing, because that means that the spies who were discovered were kind of in a rock and a hard place. Now, either it gives us the idea that you can break God's law and make a deal with somebody because you're in a rock and a hard place, and that's okay, or it gives us the idea that they went into this woman's house, who happened to be a harlot, unfortunately, but she could have been one of a foreign nation. As a matter of fact, because the word harlot can be understood in multiple different ways, one way is a woman who is in adultery or fornication with people who she should not be involved with, such as Canaanites, which God, from the time of Abraham and Noah, even, has been saying that you should not be part of. Okay, the marriage between the Canaanite people and the chosen seed line of God was not to be mixed. They weren't to be together because Canaan was cursed. All right. So we could understand that Rahab the harlot was a woman who was of either Abraham's children, one of Abraham's children, or of Seth's children, in some capacity or another, living among the Canaanite people, and therefore she was reckoned as a harlot. We have no indication that the idea of harlotry, it means that she, you know, committed lewd acts for money or something like that, even though it could just as well be understood, we could just take the word generally. But the word harlot in multiple different places, particularly in the LXX translation of Deuteronomy chapter 23, where we're told about who can enter into the congregation of Yahweh, it says in the LXX text, one who is born of a harlot, okay, which in the Hebrew we're told a mamzer, someone of a mixed race. So we know that the two can be used in the same way. Now, what does this mean? She doesn't ask for her children to be saved, if she had any. We're not told that she does or she didn't, so it's somewhat speculation. But she does ask for the life of her father, mother, brothers, and sisters, and all that they have. Okay? So, I find that interesting, that it does offer a case that perhaps the person they decided to lodge with inside of the city was one that they could speak to in their own language, maybe with somebody that they either knew or didn't know was there, and was somebody that they could felt like they could trust a little more if they did get caught, which turned out to be the case. And as a repercussion of it, Yahweh did allow them to spare her due to this repentant action by recognizing Israel as being God's people and being given the land. This harlot has possibly repented, and from what we're told about how she integrates into Israel in the future, in the next few chapters we'll read, we can understand that she did indeed repent, and she was accepted into the congregation, which is not something we would think would be done for a Canaanite due to what's said in God's law and God not having to change for men. So I think that that's something very important to remember about this. Is this is a verse that people use to try to say that God changes his standards from time to time. That God's not a real hard-nosed person when it comes to ethnic and racial intermixing. That he somehow just lightens up and somehow loosens up, and he says, you know, it's not that I can't give in a little bit, as they'd say nowadays. But indeed, I think if you follow God's reasoning, you can see more often than not there are better explanations found in the Scripture than those that we just think we can pick out of there and then use as case law that says God is just like us and he changes from time to time. But we're told God does not change. So, let's get back to the text. It says, "Then she let them down by a cord through the window, for her house was upon the town wall, and she dwelt upon the wall. And she said unto them, Get you to the mountain, lest the pursuers meet you and hide yourselves there 3 days, until the pursuers be returned, and afterward may ye go your way. And the men said unto her, We will be blameless of this thine oath, which thou hast made us swear. Behold, when we come into the land, thou shalt bind this line of scarlet thread in the window, which thou did let us down by, and thou shalt bring thy father and thy mother, and thy brethren, and all thy father's household home unto thee." Okay, well, I'm going to make one more point about Rahab before we stop talking about her, which I'll probably talk about her anyhow again, so I shouldn't say that. But the scarlet thread is an intriguing part of understanding who Rahab may have been and who her connection was with Israel. Because the scarlet thread is the thread that was tied around the hand of Zerah whenever the people of Zerah and Perez were separated from the womb, and was the line in which Christ came through. Okay, Judah was the father of Perez and Zerah to a woman named Tamar. Also a precarious situation that happened there. You have to read that for your own self, though. And the interesting thing there is the scarlet thread, the same thread is being used to say, listen, this one's separate, this one's separated. Section her off. Now, it's been presumed by others who study the Bible in the same way as we do, believing that God doesn't lie, that perhaps she was actually part of the scarlet thread, which is why she's mentioned as being part of Christ's genealogy, if it is indeed the same woman. There's reason to believe that maybe it's not. But if it is, the scarlet thread was the symbol of Zerah, which in Hebrew meant the seed. Okay, the first one to put his hand out of the womb, which was retracted. Okay, his brother was born instead of him first, but he was actually the first one out. Okay, and so by saying that, we know who she may have been from. Perhaps she was an escaped Judahite from Egypt or from the wilderness or from some other point. Who knows? Nobody's quite sure how her people would have got to Jericho prior, but it's a possibility that she was a person of that stock due to the scarlet thread, which has been one of the threads on the wrists of Zerah and found on today's European heraldry to this day, people who are related to that line of royalty. So, interesting things to consider. All right. 19. And it shall be that whosoever shall go out of the doors of thy house into the street, his blood shall be upon his head, and we will be guiltless. And whosoever shall be with thee in the house, his blood shall be on our head, if any hand be upon him. So their promise is that they will not touch them as long as they stay in the house. If you go outside and fight, well then, game's off. You fought for them, you're going to die like everybody else. 20. And if thou utter this our business, when we will be quit of thine oath, which thou hast made us to swear. So if they tell the truth that these are spies, where they went, the deal's off. We're going to kill you for that too. Okay? And they went and came unto the mountain and abode there 3 days until the pursuers were returned. And the pursuers were sought them throughout all the way, but found them not. 23. So the two men returned and descended from the mountain, and passed over, and came to Joshua the son of Nun, and told him all things that befallen them. And they said unto Joshua, Truly Yahweh has delivered into our hands all the land, for even all the inhabitants of the country do faint because of us. So Joshua is now getting told this terrific story about how great things are going to be and how this attack is going to be going so easy, which is completely opposite from the last set of spies that were sent, where only Joshua and Caleb, if you remember, Joshua and Caleb were the ones who came back and said, we can take it, no problem, God's with us. And the other guy said, we can't take it, they're too strong. Okay, this time around, the people say, we can take it, there's no problem, we're going to take it. We even got an insider, somebody who's going to be on our side and helped us out. And so it gave them courage and understanding that they were going to be able to take these people and overcome through God. 3, chapter 3. And Joshua rose early in the morning, and they removed from Shechem, and came to Jordan, he and all the children of Israel, and lodged there before they passed over. And it came to pass, after 3 days, that the officers went through the host. So they're going through the host, and they're doing exactly what the law told them to do. They commanded the people, saying, When you see the Ark of the Covenant of Yahweh your God, and the priests and the Levites bearing it, then ye shall remove from your place and go after it. They're going through their tens and fifties, hundreds and thousands, and they're telling all the people that this is the plan. This is the battle plan. And he described it. 4. Yet there shall be a space between you and it, about 2,000 cubits by measure. Come not near unto it, that ye may know the way by which ye must go, for you have not passed this way hitherto. So in other words, they had no idea where they were going. The ark and the priests were going to lead the people by the hand of Yahweh. Yahweh was somehow going to tell them how to take the army, and they had not done it before. They did not map the land to bring a whole army through it. Joshua said unto the people, Sanctify yourselves, for tomorrow Yahweh will do wonders among you. And Joshua spoke unto the priests, saying, Take up the Ark of the Covenant and pass over before the people. And they took up the Ark of the Covenant, and they went before the people. And Yahweh said to Joshua, This day will I begin to magnify thee in the sight of all Israel, that they may know that as I was with Moses, so I will be with thee. And thou shalt command the priests that bear the Ark of the Covenant, saying, When ye are come to the brink of the water of Jordan, ye shall stand still in Jordan. And Joshua said to the children of Israel, Come hither and hear the words of Yahweh your God. And Joshua said, Hereby ye shall know that the living God is among you, and that he will without fail drive out from before you the Canaanites, the Hittites, the Hivites, the Perizzites, the Girgashites, the Amorites, and the Jebusites. Behold, the Ark of the Covenant of the Lord of all the earth passes over before you into Jordan. Now therefore, take you 12 men out of the tribes of Israel, out of every tribe of man, and it shall come to pass that as soon as the soles of the feet of the priests that bear the Ark of Yahweh, the Lord of all the earth, shall rest in the waters of Jordan, that the waters of Jordan shall be cut off from the waters that come down from above, and they shall stand up as a heap. So, I think that in some ways this is kind of making the idea for everywhere your feet cross or step upon is your land to take. And God's going to show that by the soles of the priest's feet finally crossing the Jordan. As soon as it touches the banks, soon as it touches, as soon as the feet touch the border of the river, the very first inch that they crossed the land God gave to their fathers, Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, God was going to make a miracle. It was a monumentous occasion. It was going to set a thought in their mind that they were never going to forget. It was going to make Joshua the leader. No one was going to argue with his power. And it was going to make the covenant of God come to pass. That's why a miracle was chosen to be done right now. Every time the people left the borders of a land that was promised, it was promised to Abraham that the people would come out of Egypt at a set day, specific time. And so, what did he do? Made the waters part. And then whenever they get to Jordan, they're going to fulfill the covenant God made with Abraham also. The waters are going to part again, and they're going to pass over on dry land. And so God's going to use this symbol as Israel's symbol that God is with them. And they're going to follow the priests as a consequence of this. Because of what they see, it's going to confirm the priesthood as well. And it came to pass in 14... when the people removed from their tents to pass over Jordan, that the priests, bearing the Ark of the Covenant before the people, and as they that bear the Ark were come unto Jordan, and the feet of the priests that bear the Ark were dipped in the brim of the water, for Jordan overfloweth all his banks all the time of the harvest. So we understand the time period we're talking about, which archaeology has proven to be the case of when Jericho was destroyed, was definitely a time right after the harvest or during, when the pots were full of grain. And all the waters which came down from above stood and rose up upon a heap very far from the city Adam, that is beside Zaratan. And those that came down towards the sea of the plain, even the salt sea, failed. They were cut off, and the people passed over right against Jericho. Now, some people said that the possibility of this happening was maybe some guy just happened to be upstream cutting down a tree, fell across the river, diverted the water, and there you go. Even if that was the case, even if science can come up with a good explanation for it to happen at that exact time is nonetheless a miracle, no matter how it happened. But it says that whatever happened in the Jordan River backed up all the way to this other city, and the other inhabitants saw it and failed. Their hearts failed because, I mean, these people now see a big problem, and it's a symbol to them that your land, your world is going to be changed. Everything's changing right now. Okay. 17. And the priests that bear the Ark of the Covenant of Yahweh stood firm on dry ground in the midst of Jordan, and all the Israelites passed over on dry ground until all the people were passed clean over Jordan. And it came to pass, chapter 4, verse 1, when all the people were clean passed over Jordan, that Yahweh spake unto Joshua, saying, take you 12 men out of the people, out of every tribe a man, command ye them, saying, take you hence out of the midst of Jordan, out of the place where the priest's feet stood firm, 12 stones, and ye shall carry them over with you, and leave them in the lodge place where ye shall lodge this night. Then Joshua called the 12 men whom he had prepared of the children of Israel, out of every tribe a man. And Joshua said unto them, pass over before the ark of Yahweh your God into the midst of Jordan, and take you up every man of you a stone upon his shoulder, according unto the number of the tribes of the children of Israel, that this may be a sign among you, that when your children ask their fathers in times to come, saying, what mean ye by these stones? Then you shall answer them that the waters of Jordan were cut off before the Ark of the Covenant of Yahweh when it passed over Jordan. The waters of Jordan were cut off, and these stones shall be a memorial unto the children of Israel forever. And the children of Israel did so, as Joshua commanded, and took up 12 stones out of the midst of Jordan, and as Yahweh spake unto Joshua. According to the number of the tribes of the children of Israel, and carried them over with them unto the place where they lodged, and laid them down there. And Joshua set up 12 stones in the midst of Jordan, in the place where the feet of the priests which bear the Ark of the Covenant stood, and they are there unto this day. So, another monumentous thing, the priests stood in the river all night while the people passed over Jordan and got ready for the attack. Joshua was told by Yahweh to set 12 stones for the 12 tribes that crossed in that very place, so that the people could always know. I don't know if it was set in a circle necessarily, 12 stones in the middle of a circle, or if it was set like a pathway, or how it was done. We're not really told the way that it was set up. But we do know that, at least from what I've read, that these stones were observable to people in the past, that there were large stones at the place where the Arabs that lived there after Israel told the European archaeologists that this is the place and there's some of the stones. So it may not be there to this day, right now, but it was there in the past and people had written about it and observed it. I think it's a pretty impressive thing, though, to consider what God did for his people here. And we can embellish upon that a little bit at the end of the reading. For the verse 10. For the priest which bare the ark stood in the midst of Jordan until everything was finished, that Yahweh commanded Joshua to speak unto the people according to all that Moses commanded Joshua, and all the people hastened and passed over. And it came to pass, when all the people were clean passed over, that the ark of Yahweh passed over, and the priests in the presence of the people. See, that is the part that I had mentioned it, but it needs to be noticed because it's kind of spoken about twice for a reason. The priests stood in the center of the river or at the bank. It doesn't necessarily tell us where they stood. Maybe they put their feet in. As soon as their feet made the water stand still, they just stopped right there, and they stood there until everybody passed over. This was the job of the priest. This is still the job of the priest, only I think we would look at it more in a metaphorical way now. That it's the job of the ministers, the jobs of whoever is called to do the job of this service, that they are to hold back the floods of the world from the people and allow the people to pass over, the common men, the soldiers, the normal Christians who are fighting the battle. The priests sometimes stand still and just do as they're told. Okay? And I'm not by any means trying to say anybody can be a priest or a Levite or anything like that, but I do think that the idea is still set there, that when God calls people to do his work, that a lot of times they have to stand and hold back those floods. Okay, verse 12. And the children of Reuben, and the children of Gad, and the half tribe of Manasseh passed over armed before the children of Israel, as Moses spake unto them. About 40,000 prepared for war passed over before Yahweh unto battle, to the plains of Jericho. And on that day Yahweh magnified Joshua in the sight of all Israel, and they feared him, as they feared Moses all the days of his life. And Yahweh spake unto Joshua, saying, Command the priests that bear the ark of the testimony, that they come up out of Jordan. So the priests are waiting for the orders. They're not moving until they're told, like good priests, not ones that do what they want to do. Joshua therefore commanded the priests, saying, Come ye up out of Jordan. And it came to pass that when the priests that bear the ark of the covenant of Yahweh were come up out of the midst of Jordan, and the soles of the priests' feet lifted up unto the dry land, that the waters of the Jordan returned unto their place, and flowed over his banks as they did before. So once again, as soon as the soles of the foot came on the land, the people saw that the waters returned. And the people came up out of Jordan on the 10th day of the first month, and they encamped in Gilgal in the east border of Jericho. Now, what special thing happens on the 10th day of the first month? The lamb selected for Passover, right? So, as soon as they get over the lamb is selected for the Passover. Same time period, and I think we're going to find that immediately after that, the people start thinking about that. Those 12 stones which they took out of Jordan did Joshua pitch in Gilgal. And he spake unto the children of Israel, saying, When your children shall ask their fathers in time to come, saying, What mean these stones? Then ye shall let your children know, saying, Israel came over this Jordan on dry land. And Yahweh your God dried up the waters of the Jordan from before you until ye were passed over. As Yahweh your God did to the Red Sea, which he dried up from before us until we were gone over, that all the people of the earth might know the hand of Yahweh, that it is mighty, and that ye might fear Yahweh your God forever. So there's a twofold purpose for these miracles. The first one is that all the people of the earth, which could just as well be translated all the peoples of this land, the lands of Canaan, would know that Yahweh did this. And the second reason is so that Israel would know that Yahweh's hand was mighty. So that both people, everybody you could say, everybody would know that Israel's God was God, was the God of gods. He was the mighty God. He was the God that could do things. Very important. 5. And it came to pass that when all the kings of the Amorites which were on the side of Jordan westward, and all the kings of the Canaanite which are by the sea, probably the Great Sea, the Mediterranean Sea, heard that Yahweh had dried up the waters of Jordan from before the children of Israel until we were passed over, that their heart melt, neither was their spirit in them any more, because of the children of Israel. At that time Yahweh said unto Joshua, Make thee sharp knives, and circumcise again the children of Israel the second time. Joshua made him sharp knives, and circumcised the children of Israel at the hill of the foreskins, which is called Gilgal. And this is the cause why Joshua did circumcise. So the writer's feeling like you got to explain some stuff here. Now listen carefully. It's very important in, I think, a Christian understanding of circumcision. All the people that came out of Egypt that were males, even all the men of war, they died in the wilderness by the way, after they came out of Egypt. So all the people died because of their transgression. God killed all the men who were circumcised in Egypt. Now all the people that came out were circumcised, he says. But all the people that were born in the wilderness by the way as they came forth out of Egypt, them they had not circumcised. So in other words, while the people were wandering around the wilderness, not coming into the land of promise, which if you remember, the circumcision was not just a covenant or a seal of the faith of Abraham, but it was also a covenant of the land that was given to the people. They did not circumcise their children. They were in rebellion. For the children of Israel walked 40 years in the wilderness, till all the people that were men of war which came out of Egypt were consumed, because they obeyed not the voice of Yahweh, unto whom Yahweh sware that he would not show them the land which Yahweh swore to their fathers that he would give us, a land that floweth with milk and honey. And their children whom he raised up in their stead, them Joshua circumcised, for they were uncircumcised until they had not circumcised them by the way, because they hadn't done it along the road. And it came to pass that when they had done circumcising all the people, that they abode in their place in the camp till they were whole, until they were healthy again. So, the explanation that has been given is that the people were in rebellion. They had forgotten their covenant. There were some people like Joshua and Caleb that knew what was right. Moses was even with them. The lawgiver, Moses, stood by quietly, you could say, while the people didn't do this. That's probably because the people did these things in private. But apparently they weren't keeping up with it. Maybe it was because Moses just didn't really care if they did it or not. They were already a rebellious people that were going to die. Okay, repentance was not an option. The door or the window had been shut. They were not going to make it into the promised land, and that was that. And so circumcision here was done, though, after that generation was definitely 8 days old, after they were already men of war, after they had already passed over the Jordan, after the tribe of Reuben, Gad, and the half-tribe Manasseh won a battle. So all these men who did this were uncircumcised. Okay, so the idea that circumcision somehow in act would not allow them to be victorious on account of it being part of God's law or God's commands did not come into effect, though, because the people had faith. Okay? And so because the people had faith at the beginning, while they were ignorant to their sin, God winked at it, God allowed for it, and God allowed them to be victorious and used them still as their instruments, just like Israel, who has forgot their way many, many times thereafter, has forgotten its way, and unfortunately to this day is starting to not circumcise. But for those of us who are Christians, who want to walk in the faith of Abraham, I'd recommend reading Romans, starting in 1, and ending probably in 7 or 8, and if not 9 or 10, and seeing a holistic understanding of how circumcision works and how circumcision has a value if it is done by righteous people. People with faith, people who walk in the faith of Abraham. In this case, God told Joshua, now it's time to circumcise, which was a requirement for keeping the Passover. Okay, which can be seen in Exodus chapter 12 and 13. Which I have to make a redactment that in Isaiah, it was actually Isaiah 23, I was told. Or 53, not Isaiah 52. So, that I quoted earlier. So cross that out for referencing. So 8 says that it came to pass when they were done circumcising all the people that they abode in their place till they were whole, so till the people were better. When the people were better, they got ready to war again. But before the war, it says in 9, and Yahweh said to Joshua, this day have I rolled away the reproach of Egypt from off you. Wherefore the name of the place is called Gilgal unto this day, or the place of rolling away. And the children of Israel encamped in Gilgal, and kept the Passover on the 14th day of the month, at even in the plains of Jericho. And remember, Passover is celebrated on the 14th at even, right after evening. The twilight comes, the full darkness and the stars appear. That's accounted as the 15th day. So, when it says they kept the Passover, it means they killed the lamb on the 14th day, as the commandment says, and in the 15th they would have eaten their lamb. On the 10th day, when they just got out of the Jordan, they had to select their lamb. So Passover was on their mind from the time they got over the Jordan into the plains of Jericho. 11 says, and they did eat of the old corn of the land on the morrow after they passed over, unleavened cakes and parched corn in that selfsame day. So the next miracle appears. And the manna ceased on the morrow, after they had eaten of the old corn of the land. Neither had the children of Israel manna any more, but they did eat of the fruit of the land of Canaan on that year. And it came to pass that when Joshua was by Jericho, that he lifted up his eyes and he looked, and behold, there stood a man over against him with his sword drawn in his hand. So Joshua sees a man standing there with a sword brandished, you know, maybe even looking like he's ready to fight. And Joshua boldly comes up to him, and what's he say? He went to him and said unto him, "Art thou for us or for our adversary?" Which could just as well be translated, "Are you for us or for Satan?" And he said, "Nay, but as captain of the host of Yahweh am I now come." And Joshua fell on his face to the earth, and he did worship. And he said to him, "What saith my Lord unto his servant?" And the captain of Yahweh's host said unto Joshua, "Loose thy shoes from off thy foot, for the place whereon thou stands is holy." And Joshua did so. So we can look back into the text, and we see this. By miracles, God brought Israel over the Jordan in an uncircumcised, unrepentant state. By the hand of a harlot did the spies get to go back to tell Joshua the report that was given. We see also, though, the people are in entire subjection to Joshua as the commander of the army, that they respect him just like they respected Moses, that the priests were respecting Yahweh and doing what they were told. They stood still until a whole host of people passed over the Jordan. We also see that Reuben, Gad, the half-tribe of Manasseh are all in obedience to God's law and to Joshua as the leader. We also see that when the time came, which was probably one of the most trying times, okay, and maybe the reason Yahweh left this time until after the crossing of the Jordan was the time of Gilgal, the time of the rolling away of the reproach of Egypt. And the reproach of Egypt does not refer to the enslavement of Egypt. It refers to the slave mentality that Israel had because they wanted to return to Egypt. They wanted to go back to slavery over taking the promised land. They thought it was easier to become slaves again than it was to conquer a strong enemy. Okay? And their non-circumcision, which was the way they looked at the covenant God made with Abraham, okay, a covenant which we are told is a covenant of faith, a covenant of righteousness. Okay, faith meaning they believed that God would give them the land of Canaan. That's what Abraham believed. That's why he accepted the seal of circumcision. Israel at that time was not in that state like they are in this time in the 21st century, which is why we don't practice circumcision right now. We don't believe in God's word, God's law, God's commandments, and God's victory. We don't have God's faith. We don't have God's righteousness on our heart. So because of it, we don't put our trust in the idea of cutting a little piece of skin off of a newborn baby's private part. Okay? Which little thing amounted to big things. What happened after that? After the Israel had rolled their reproach away and had been in strict obedience to God's law to get circumcised, okay, after the Jordan was parted, which is why I said it was the monumentous thing. Maybe if it wasn't for that, they said, "Hey, buddy, we're not cutting our bodies. We're not doing that." They might not have wanted to get circumcised if they didn't just see the Jordan get stopped in its place. Okay? And then as the people had their faith now in Joshua, Yahweh, and God's promises, they committed to it just as Christian circumcision is supposed to be. All right, it's not the it does anything of itself. Paul tells us circumcision avails nothing and uncircumcision avails nothing but the keeping of the commandments of God. Paul also tells us circumcision avails nothing and uncircumcision does nothing but works that are done by love. Okay? That there is a way and a method for people to follow God's law, even this law, even to this day. And that once the people had been circumcised, they, according to the law, were able to keep the Passover. Because they had kept the Passover, which was a celebration of the harvest, the manna was stopped, and because the manna was stopped, the people ate of the new corn of the land. They were able to eat of the old store of the land. And because of that, they were now able to move on to a victorious battle that started with the captain of Yahweh's own army appearing to them, so that they knew that their victory would be complete.